Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Rick Rockner. I appear on behalf of the defendants appellants Colleen Carmichael and Terry Carter, sisters of the ward Gregory Cloberdance and the daughters of the plaintiff Louise Cloberdance. As I'm sure the court is aware, this case arose in 2009 when a complaint was filed against my clients to impose a constructive trust and for return of the property that was in that constructive trust to the plaintiff Louise Cloberdance. In 2001, Louise Cloberdance had transferred her house to my clients for the intent of preserving that property for the benefit of Gregory Cloberdance, who is a disabled adult. The court made the finding in paragraph 16 of its findings that that was the intent of the parties, to protect that house and property for Gregory Cloberdance, and indeed the evidence at trial by both sides was that that was the intent of the parties. The only issue here today is not whether a constructive trust should have been imposed or the terms and conditions of that constructive trust, but whether that complaint to enforce the constructive trust was timely filed. The parties were in agreement at trial that the three-year statute of limitations contained in 1380.101F is the appropriate statute of limitations, and that a cause of action for constructive trust must be brought 3 years after the cause of action accrues. What is at issue in this case is what constitutes an accrual of that cause of action. The defendants and the appellants in this case argued at trial court and argue here again that when the beneficiary of a trust, in this case Louise Cloberdance, even though that was contested at trial, that Gregory should have been the intended beneficiary, but when the beneficiary is found by the court, Louise Cloberdance, when she had to bring her cause of action, did that accrue when she makes her demand for performance, i.e. a return of the property to her, and it's not acted upon? Or did it occur at a later point in time than 2004? It is clear under the law, and again, both parties agree, that a repudiation occurs when the trustee shows a refusal to perform. Both parties cited the Harry V. Rabb Foundation case, and there are numerous other cases that so hold that same thing, including the Vandeweel case, also cited by both of the parties. The issue again, though, is what is a refusal to perform? We argue that a refusal to perform is when that demand is made, and it's a clear demand made, and there's no action on that demand, that statute of limitations begins to run. Indeed, we have argued, most importantly, in our reply brief, that it would make no sense otherwise. A repudiation has to occur when a demand is made and not acted upon, whether it's an affirmative, oral, or written denial of that request. Let me give the court an example and why it's important as far as precedent in the law to indicate that a simple failure to act is tantamount to a refusal to act. Let me use this example in addition to the other ones that I had in my brief. Let's assume there are two parties. One party purchases a landscape contract from another party, and that performance on the landscaper's part is to be upon demand. In other words, it's a problem with the lawn. The homeowner or the business owner that has the contract makes a demand. And the homeowner makes a demand upon the landscape artist or the landscaper to fix a problem with grub worms in the lawn. And the landscaper just never shows up. And 6 years or 7 years later, and let's assume it's still within the contract period, it was a 10 or 12 year contract, the landowner then brings suit saying, my yard died 7 years ago because you didn't show up. That would simply not be allowed. Why? Because that failure to act is a repudiation of that situation.
After, yes. I think you're hypothetical, though. What if the landscaper told the owner, I'll get around to it, you just hold your horses, be patient, I'll get around to it, and kept telling the owner that he would get around to it. It's not a refusal.
I would agree that that would be an equitable tolling of the statute if those facts were there.
Well, don't we have a factual finding in this case, a factual finding by the trial court, that your clients led Ms. Kloberdance to believe that they would reconvey the property to her before, that is, before June of 2007?
Well, and I'll address that two parts, addressing 2007 and that finding. The court did state that in its findings. Indeed, the appellee has argued that same point in its brief, but there is absolutely no place in the record whatsoever, nor is it cited in the appellee's brief or by the court, where there's any evidence of that type of inducement to plaintiff not to take action. There was simply silence. There was no indication or testimony by anyone that there was ever any statement made, quite frankly, until 2008, when there were letters with counsel that were exchanged. There was no evidence. And we have argued that in our briefs. If there were such evidence, then I would agree. But researching the record in its entirety, that type of evidence just never appeared in the record. There was a silence on behalf of the defendants.
Are there any cases that talk about exactly this issue, whether silence constitutes a repudiation?
I cited the Dennison versus Barney case in my brief. Interestingly, and I always like this when this happens, we're talking old cases.
1911 was it?
1911 case, the Dennison case. I'd also refer the court to a 1905 case from the Supreme Court, which is Austin versus Van Loon. It's at 36 Colorado 196. And that was a cattle case where one person here in Colorado had placed his cattle in possession of another rancher to take them to, I believe it was to New Mexico, to graze. And the rancher who had originally owned the cattle asked for the cattle back. And there was silence. There was no action in returning the cattle. And the issue came up as to when the statute of limitations ran. And the court indicated there that the statute of limitations began to run when the demand for the return of the property was made. And I say it's very similar to this situation. In other words, there's a deposit of property. There's, in essence, a constructive trust if the intended purpose was simply to obtain better grazing for the cattle and then a refusal to return the property. That's when it started to run. And as I indicated in my brief, I gave other examples. You could even have situations such as a regulation or a zoning ordinance that says if a homeowner is given notice to cut the weeds and they fail to cut the weeds, that a county has a certain period of time to respond. It doesn't take the homeowner to contact the county back and say, I'm not going to do it, to cause that to happen. The failure to act in and of itself must be considered an act of repudiation. Otherwise, as I also indicated in my brief, it's an infinite period of time before any statute of limitations could run. You could keep making the demand each and every year, and there's silence. When we get 20 years later, and the statute is not run, that's not what the law should be. If there are no further questions this time, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time because of the other issues on cross-appeal that I would like to address in rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Steve Furman, attorney registration number 007682. I represent the plaintiff, Louise Kloberdance. The issue on the constructive trust really does boil down, it seems to me, to two issues. One, did in fact, and was there evidence in the record to support the trial court's conclusion that the plaintiff was assured, at least prior to June of 2007, that she could have a house back when she wanted to. In fact, there is plenty of support in the record for that proposition. Louise Kloberdance herself testified she was always told prior to 2008 that she could have a house conveyed back to her when she wanted. Anita Cabasa testified that in 2003 or 2004, in response to a question from Louise Cloverdance, Colleen Carmichael said, "The house is yours," referring to meaning that the house is Louise Cloverdance's. Anita Cabasa also testified that when the issue of insurance came up, the fact that Louise Cloverdance was paying for the insurance on the house, and Anita Cabasa asked both defendants, "Why is my mother paying for insurance on the house if the house is in your name?" They both said, "It's because it's your mother's house." It was clear from the record, and there was plenty of record support to support the assertion and the trial court's findings, that Louise Cloverdance was always told, at least prior to June of 2007, that the house was hers and she could have it back when she wanted. More importantly, or just as important, the issue becomes, can mere silence or a neglect to act represent a repudiation of a constructive trust? The example cited by counsel for the defendants really has no application. That is it's just a straight business transaction between a landscaper and an owner. It doesn't have any of the attributes of a constructive trust where there is a confidential relationship between two parties, which the case law clearly states that confidential relationship lessens the responsibility of the person who relies on that relationship to investigate or do things that they would normally do outside of a confidential relationship. The case, I think, that is actually really does address this issue in a large degree as to whether silence or mere inaction upon a request can not constitute repudiation of the trust is Bushner v. Bushner. It's cited in the brief at 307 P. 2nd 204. The facts of that case are, in its important parts, are almost identical to the facts of this case. In that case, we had two brothers. At one point, actually, the defendant had transferred the real property to the plaintiff. They had owned that property as tenants in common prior to the transfer by the defendant to the plaintiff, because the defendant was having marital problems and apparently he wanted to keep the property out of any claims by his wife. Then in 1933, the reverse happened. The plaintiff transferred the property, the entire property, back to the defendant. And this took place in 1933. The trial court found that starting in 1935 until 1952, at various times, the plaintiff had requested the property, his interest in the property, be reconveyed to him, but that the defendant didn't say no, the defendant just didn't do it. Finally, in 1952, when the accountings from the defendant stopped and he stopped paying money on this property that at that point had become farm property, the plaintiff then made another demand on the defendant to return his interest to him. And at that point, in 1952, the defendant directly refused to reconvey the property. And according to the trial court's finding, that was the first time that the defendant had made a direct refusal to return the property. The argument was made that the statute of limitations had run long before when the prior request to return the property had been made. The Supreme Court said no, that the only time the statute started to run was in 1952 when there was a direct refusal to return the property, and that's directly the case here. At the earliest, there was a direct refusal to return the property in June of 2007. At the earliest, there was no direct refusals prior to that. There's no evidence in the record of any direct refusals prior to that time. In fact, it could even be argued that the only real direct refusal that took place was in August of 2008, when there were the letters between the attorneys at the time. And in the August of 2008 letters, the letter from defense counsel to then plaintiff's counsel, which basically stated, "We don't intend to do anything with the property." That was really, in a real sense, the first direct refusal to return the property. But even if this court accepts the trial court's findings that as of June 2007, my client should have been aware that there were disagreements about the property, the case was filed in July of 2009, way within the 3-year statute of limitations. And there are other cases that basically say the same thing. There's the Olin versus Gary case. That case basically says that the statute of limitations does not accrue in this kind of a constructive trust action until there is an open, their language is, until there is an open disavowal of the trust. There was no open disavowal of this trust prior at its earliest to June of 2007. The record is clear about that, Your Honors, and we really see no basis to overturn the trial court's determination about when the refusal was really first made. And I would submit, Your Honor, we are here. This is a question of fact and law as to when the statute of limitations accrued. And the standard review has to be clearly erroneous. There is nothing in the trial court's findings, which are quite detailed and quite lengthy. It's a well-reasoned, well-thought-out, detailed opinion, which clearly indicates that the statute of limitations at its earliest did not accrue until June of 2007. We have also cross-appealed, and I would like to discuss those issues, if I might. The issue that I think is the most important issue is the issue of whether we have the rights in prejudgment interest. We saw in the trial court prejudgment interest basically from the date of the repudiation of the trust, which the court basically found took place in June of 2007. The court on that issue simply stated in a one-sentence finding that the plaintiff would be made whole once the property was returned to her, and therefore denied our request for prejudgment interest. I would submit that determination by the court was error as a matter of law. CRS 5-12-1021B provides for interest at 8% per annum, compounded annually for all monies or the value of all property after they are wrongfully withheld. In the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company case versus Holmes, a 2008 Colorado Supreme Court case that we cited, the court held that the purpose of prejudgment interest, of the prejudgment interest statute, is that the plaintiff suffers a loss when the money or property is wrongfully withheld. The court further held that this loss value is caused by inflation, reduction in the value of money over time, and the plaintiff's inability due to the withholding of his or her money or property to earn a return on it. The court further stated that the plaintiff is not required to prove the amount of actual loss caused by the wrongful withholding. Rather, the statute awards prejudgment interest at the statutory rate of 8% In effect, the court held that the statute presumes the amount of time value of money the plaintiff loses every year when his money or property is withheld. The court further held that the function of prejudgment interest is to compensate for the time value of money without proof of actual loss. There is no requirement that the plaintiff prove any actual loss to get prejudgment interest. And I would submit when the trial court held that the plaintiff would be made whole once the property was returned to her, in effect, the court was ruling that the plaintiff was required to show some actual loss from the withholding of the property. But that, as a matter of law, is clearly not the law in the state of Colorado, and that is not the function of prejudgment interest. And the function of prejudgment interest is to presume that this is the amount of the time value of lost money. So we would submit that we are entitled to prejudgment interest as a matter of law from the time the trial court found that there had been a withholding of the property. And we would submit that the withholding of the property, based on the trial court's findings, took place in June of 2007 when the court found in its findings that there was a definite demand made by the plaintiff on the defendants to return the home to her, and they refused to return the home. We also believe, Your Honors, that we are entitled to attorney fees. We make this request on two bases. The first basis is a general exception to the American rule regarding that each party pays their own attorney fees, and that exception relates to when there is a breach of a trust, or I would submit a breach of a fiduciary duty, as set forth in the conservatorship of Roth case, that the person whose who brings the lawsuit and who has suffered the damages from the breach of the trust of fiduciary duty is entitled to their reasonable attorney fees in order to make them whole. Now, the trial court determined that that was not applicable here because the court found that there was no breach of a specific fiduciary duty, basically. I believe that is just plain, as a matter of law, incorrect. The court, first of all, there's general law. The general law is that when there is a constructive trust, the equity converts the transferee into a trustee. He holds that property in trust for the beneficiary. And in that sense, he is no different than any other trustee who is required to fulfill the obligations of his trust. Now, what were the obligations of the trust in this case? It is clear from the evidence. Starting in 2000, in October of 2000, when this property, while my client was in the hospital after surgery, when this property was deeded to her, it was clear from the beginning that she could have this property back when she wanted it back and when she asked for it back. That was the agreement. The basis for the agreement, or for her deeding the property over to the defendants, was that she was afraid she would have to go into a nursing home, and that if she went into a nursing home, she was concerned that the equity in the property would be lost. And we don't dispute that the equity in the property was supposed to be under this deed for the benefit of Gregory, who was a disabled adult. But that does not mean that my client could not change her mind. That does not mean my client could say, I want my property back. It's her property, equitably, it's her property. They held nothing more than a bare legal title, and she had the right at any time she wanted to request the property back. Once, at least when the court found, in June of 2007, they refused to honor that demand. They, in effect, breached their fiduciary duty to return the property to her when she requested it.
Assuming you're correct, did the court have any discretion at that point to decide, well, it's a family case, I'm not going to do it, or was it mandatory?
No, I believe under the circumstances of this case, it was mandatory to award the attorney fees, just like I understand the case law holds that the trial court has discretion to order attorney fees in a breach of trust case. And I understand that's what the case law says, but if the purpose is to make the person whole, and that's the purpose, then why should Louise Clobodance be out her attorney fees that she incurred and not be made whole because these defendants breached their duty? And now we have a situation where the defendants don't even contest that there was a constructive trust, that the constructive trust was breached, and that the property should have been returned. Their defense now, different than it was in the trial court where all these issues were raised as defenses, their defense now is solely that the statute of limitations is rough. That's solely their defense. If it was clear that there was a breach of the constructive trust, and that this property was held in constructive trust, and there's really no argument against that. Everybody admitted at trial, even the defendants, this was not a gift. They admitted they paid no consideration for the property, and they admitted that they could not do with the property as they wished. Given all those circumstances, it is hard for me to understand how, because she was forced to go through a trial to prove that she was entitled to a constructive trust, why she should not be given her attorney fees at this point.
I have just one more question, Mr. Furman. I notice you share the same name as one of our colleagues. I assume you would represent on the record that there is no connection. I don't see any physical resemblance, but I could be wrong. Just the record.
Your Honor, as far as I know, there's no relationship between us.
So thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Reffner, you have about 6 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me comment first on the Bushner case. The counsel argued that that is a clear case showing that silence alone in the wake of a demand is not enough to trigger repudiation and thus a running of the statute. There's something very different in Bushner, as I recall the facts. In Bushner, although the demand was made for the conveyance to the other brother,
and it was not acted upon, and he never refused or said, I'm not going to do it. What the other brother did do is continue to convey resources and funds from that property, rents and other things to that, and is indicative that I'm recognizing that you have a claim or a constructive trust on this property. That's very different than we have here. We only have silence. We have no other act whatsoever to show consistency with the stated purpose of the constructive trust from 2004 on. There's a glaring inconsistency in not only the court's finding, but also the briefs and oral argument of the plaintiff in this case. And that glaring inconsistency is that the plaintiff is indicating that it should have a right to interest going back to the middle of 2007. Why is that inconsistent? Because they're saying the cause of action arose. But the facts in this case show nothing different happened at that time of that request than happened at the, as the plaintiff herself has testimony, numerous requests since 2004 to return the property. There's another request in 2007. The only difference is three other siblings heard it. There still is silence on behalf of the defendants.
When again was the repudiation? The actual you're not getting it back, Mother?
That was in late 08, after a letter from counsel to me, and I believe it's Exhibits 17, 22, and 23. That occurred in 08.
So you're thinking that if they are entitled to interest, it would be just in late 08?
Well,
I'm
making the point is there's a very inconsistent finding, not only by the court, mm-hmm. without any facts to support it, as well as the plaintiff, in saying that the cause of action accrued then. Why did they say the cause of action accrued then? Because there was a refusal to perform. There's nothing else.
Right, but if we were, assume for the moment that we were bound by law that says she is entitled to interest, when would you suggest that interest begin?
Well, if you would find that, and I've argued against it in my brief, would certainly not be before the formal demand was made and rejected in late 2008. But I don't even think that would be correct. And finally, with regard to the inconsistent argument that I've talked about, you have to look at statements made in the plaintiff's opening brief in this case that interest should commence July 1, 2007. They go on to indicate that the interest should be calculated because that's when the cause of action arose that entitles to interest. And again, the only thing, if that is true, the only thing that would trigger that is the silence of the defendants. And that same silence is the same silence that occurred in 2004. And there is no other evidence to indicate otherwise. Counsel referred to the testimony of Anita Kielbasa, Gregory Cloberdance's sister. I asked the court to carefully review that testimony. And it starts at pages 127 of the trial transcript on April 19th and go through the specific statement. Anita Kielbasa is not testifying that she heard at any time between 2004 and 2008 that the defendants would give the house back to the mother. Indeed, testimony about that, the only testimony, that's what the defendants purportedly told their mother at the time that the trust was created, i.e. when the conveyance occurred back in 2001. There's no evidence by anyone, including that of Anita Kielbasa, that she heard the defendants say, we'll get the house back to you, Mom. We'll do that. These defendants fought vigorously and hard to protect that property for their brother Gregory. That's what they were doing then. That's what they're doing now. There was nothing groundless or vexatious about that defense, no ill motive in that defense whatsoever. Attorney's fees should not be granted based upon those grounds. But more importantly, and I believe, Judge Rothenberg, you indicated that the question about discretionary attorney's fees, even in the exceptional case of a breach of trust, are discretionary with the court. and that discretion will not be overturned unless there was a gross abuse of that discretion. And this court, in paragraphs 21 through 24 of its findings, set forth its rationale and why it is not an abuse of discretion to deny attorney's fees in this case. And for those reasons, we would request that the two issues on appeal by the plaintiff, that be the interest as well as the attorney's fees, be denied. We would ask that the court find that repudiation occurred when the demand for return of the property first happened, i.e. in 2004, and thus the statute of limitations bars the claim. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments today. The opinion will be issued in due course, as that was